So last session we were talking about you finishing up in Madrid.
Oh yeah. With regard to that, the Library of Congress thing, they have since. I didn't tell you that. The Library of Congress have since received the microfilm of the whole series that I was interested in at the time, and a number of times I borrowed from them my work later on there, but I've got the full value of the AHN, the Archivo Histórico Nacional, which is a main source for official policy in the main. However, from Madrid I went to Seville, which has the greatest repository of materials that I have, where I worked for some 9 months or more. I was very fortunate in employing two French-born French teachers who were living in Seville. And they could not type, but they did copy the French materials, of which there are many, in the Archivo in Seville. They were busy for not only the more or less the year that I was in Spain, but for the next 2 to 3 years, copying documents with me. They were the most efficient copyists that I've ever had. They were very anxious, very sincere, very intelligent, and extremely capable in both French and Spanish. And that made it important because I impressed upon them the importance that I wanted the copying done exactly as is, with mistakes and everything in it, which they were very faithful about. But knowing both Spanish and French into there, they every once in a while would put in pencil above their writing there what the modern equivalent is of the old phonetic spelling that many of the documents in, which aided us a great deal later on in translating. Of course, in Seville, there are quite a number of very efficient copyists in the archives. I hired two of them, typical Spaniards, who, when they worked hard. But I learned very quickly the secret of the whole thing, because the Spaniards in those days, especially those that I knew of in Seville, would work until they would get their first pay, after which you don't expect them to have any work until they are absolutely hungry, and they will come to you first to borrow on their next allotment or so. Well, I learned the secret of that from my Spanish friends very early, because every Saturday night the two French and the two Spanish copyists that I had would appear in my hotel and receive their weekly sums of money that I paid them, paying them generally by the page for copying of documentation. But I never expected them to be at work on Monday morning, which they never did. One of them showed up on Wednesday, would work hard as can be until he got his pay on Saturday. And that was it. The unfortunate part was that about 2 years after I had left and they were still winding up their copying for me, one of them died. And I was asked to hire his widow, which I did, to help out in the copying, the finishing up. She is a nice woman. I knew her very well, but I'm glad that she didn't have to copy very many, because they are not as reliable as the previous ones were.
Now, are these people, that's their way of being employed in those
days?
Yes,
that's their employment. No, except that my French girl, one of them was a teacher.
You happened to?
I happened to get her at the right time through friends. I've forgotten the precise friendship. I think it was done by one of the archivists, and being one of the friends of one of the archivists themselves, that I got them.
So what papers were they working on it?
What they were doing here in Seville, the major documentation for me is to be found, especially in the section called the Papeles Procedentes de la Isla de Cuba, or called the Papeles de Cuba. These were the papers of the Captaincy General of Cuba, which was the headquarters of the materials for the province of Louisiana. And these are the papers that were transferred to Spain when Cuba became independent after the Spanish-American War. That is only one of about 12, I believe it is, divisions in the archives itself, of which there are several others that have some scattered materials for me. But the chief materials are in that particular series or section of the archives, and they were not very well kept. Until in 1929, when they had an exposition in Spain, then they did take a better care of them, for a few of them, at least protecting them from the moths and
mice
and everything else. But many a document has been crushed because of poor handling,
right,
and because of what we call polilla, that's the silver bug.
Silverfish,
which get into it and has caused a great deal of trouble.
Now, has that been replaced now by our scholars working off of microfilm today, or do you know?
No. The Library of Congress has photostats or microfilms of a good many volumes, chiefly those relating to the period of the American Revolution, but others as well. There are a number of institutions now in the United States that have had copies and now microfilms of various parts of it.
Mm-hmm.
But no place is there a complete
collection
of them that I know of. The University of California has some, and the University of Texas has some. But the last great projects that I know of is by Tulane. No, it wasn't Tulane. It was Loyola of New Orleans. And one other institution are now having complete microfilms of a number of series made.
Mm-hmm.
Oh no. My work and what I had from the archives in Spain, which constitutes the main portion of my own collection, which now probably has 400,000 sheets, I guess, more or less, but I've added to them from microfilms and from others in it, of which I myself have probably used maybe 20%, no more than that, in my publications so far. This trip here was the basic trip for me, mm-hmm, both for my hobby in France and my research work in both France and Spain. In it. Now, when I came back to San Diego, we were moved into our new building.
Here on campus?
Here on campus.
Which
here.
Building was that?
That was the administration building, the old library with the tower, not the addition, and the what is now the campus laboratories, not the old one, not the new one.
The old campus lab?
The old campus lab were open. Before I left for Europe, we had had our what do you call groundbreaking ceremonies, which was a very interesting situation because there was no paved highway from El Cajon, so they had more or less to clear some boarding of a road, a little bit of it. There was a slight argument as to just where the center of the problem would be, and all we had were rattlesnakes around it, but we had it there. The idea of building out here, of course, was because just before I came to San Diego, there had been a vote on acquiring the property in Florida Canyon, right now what more or less part of what the government wants it. It's Balboa Park, really,
right.
For the campus, but the voters turned us down. That happened just before I came to San Diego, 6 months or so. Then a company, a land company, offered us 25 acres or whatever the number was, I forgot now, the basic one out here. And this is what was accepted. And this is what we dedicated. We built our original building to house a maximum of 3,000 students. We came out here with about half that number, or a little bit less at the time. And we thought we were going out into the wilderness. There was, let's see, I believe with the exception of one house at 54th Street, there was no houses beyond Fairmont at the time, or Euclid. Into there, El Cajon Boulevard had a garden in the middle of it, up the streets from where we were before. I was saved, however, the moving problem because I was in Europe.
You were gone.
I was gone in Europe, and they moved in the middle of the semester. Yes, it was in February, I believe it was, in 1931, that we moved out here. And we were in here one semester. The history department at that time, made up of Dr. Leonard and Dr. Leslie and myself, occupied the three offices in the so-called tower of the library, just overlooking the reading room of the library. Inside it was the old library, a building in there, which wasn't open onto it, and I suppose we made so much noise that we had to enclose it later on into there. But that was the history department office, my office, for a long time, many years.
Now, did you come back in June of that year?
I came back in August of that year. Yes, I came back in August of that year, September term, many months here. I was back in this country about a month or two before, and went back to the routine.
Now, I read in one of a newspaper article that you said, or you felt that your students during the Depression were the hardest working students you ever had.
It's coming in next.
I was wondering if you'd comment on that.
Yes, I will in a few moments.
All right.
With regard to that, I'm trying to get started on what happened after I got back.
Okay.
When I got back, it was on the old proposition that I was still assistant professor, and I had been given, as I think I stated before, by President Hardy, an extension class in Latin American or Inter-American relations. And when I got back, Dr. Leonard said that I should give an upper division course. And so I said, okay. The field open was Latin American at the time, because I was giving that as a course. And so I began to develop that. So I had a program. I also, shortly thereafter, on my return, insisted that the history of England was not a good lower division course and should be made an upper division course, which we did. We changed the number from 5A to 151 AB at that time. And so I was then giving courses, my lower division course, History 8A and 8B on the Americas, my course on the history of the West, the Westward Movement, my course on England and Latin America. Now, as it turned out to be much later on, but I'm inserting it here, is that I had never had any formal training in English history, and hence when we got to a position during the war, after the war, of adding, the first addition that was made to the department was made in a professor trained in English history, Richard Webb, who came in, and therefore I gave up my English history, which I was glad to do after I had taught it for 18 years and learned a great deal about it, and probably was more effective in that than anyone else. Most of the students in that course were, of course, the pre-legal boys who got the advantage of the fact that I had to study by myself medieval history of England, which is, of course, the pre-legal and what's interesting to them. And most of them praised me for the job that I did in training them, not so much on the modern period as I did on the medieval period itself in England. Later on, as we expanded further, we wanted to add another man, the best field to give up was my own first field, which was Western history, which I gave up when we hired Martin Ridge much later on into there. And that left me as a Latin Americanist. Now, insofar as Latin America is concerned, although I was far from being ignorant of it, I never had too much training in formal training and specific training in it. I had had a great deal of work and training in the history of Mexico and in the overall history of Latin America, which is included in my history of the Americas into there. And so I developed into Latin America and worked hard on that course for many years, as a result of which I was turned into a Latin Americanist and a colonial Latin Americanist, because, as I think I explained a long time ago, my original field was in the West, but it happens to be in the Anglo-Spanish 18th century, hence I became a colonial Mexican historian in the main as my specialty of that field. But I had many other connections with it. Ever since I gave that course, and even before, because of my interest in interesting students in history and my History of the Americas course, in there, I was connected with about everything connected with Latin America in locally in this country. And during the exposition, I was one of the organizers of the Pan-American League, and also one of the organizers of the Latin American Cottage, and also was appointed first as acting and then later confirmed as Vice Consul of Paraguay in San Diego. When the consul was called away, he recommended me evidently, and so I was appointed Vice Consul of Paraguay, acting in 1936, and then appointed officially without the acting by the government in 1939 or 40 by Este Toribio. There were a number of things connected with the college during the early 30s. First of all, when we were raised first to a state teachers' college, granting the AB, but only with the required 12 units in education, and then made a state college, giving the AB, limited to the AB, which occurred after the war, or during the war, I forgot now which it was, right after, I think it was, when we got increased students. But when I returned from Europe in 1931, there was practically no one on the faculty engaged in research and publication, and hence I was somewhat looked down upon as an academic freak of some sort. However, that never bothered me, but in the background of Dr. Leonard and myself, we were always looking forward to the time when we would give some graduate work which has something to do with research, right, these, as well as granting the secondary credential, which we were granted, and gave us a first year of graduate work right after the war. As a result of which, we began to look around in our own fields, and we began to build up the library. This was done in two different ways, in one of which we were unique as a department on the campus. We decided that we would, since the library appropriations amounted to less than peanuts, as a matter of fact, I think most of the years I must have gotten an allotment of $20 to $30, and that's about all we get. So we could hardly keep up even with any current publications of that. So Dr. Leonard and I began to beg, borrow, and steal. He was working on the government, and I was working on historical societies and other peoples around there, and with some of the Middle Western book dealers who were second-hand dealers in my own field, because I realized that I can't put in the materials that I needed to for my own work. That was the reason why I had to go to Los Angeles, and then always did my work every summer in the Bancroft Library into here. As a result of which, we built up a what I call for ourselves a tremendous, in quotes, a collection of broken sets. This is seen in two different ways. The ones that we got some of the most important standard and very rare stuff at a relatively cheap price because we brought up the broken sets. They were really broken. Much later on, we were able to fill in some of them,
right,
and not all of them. But also, I began my, since I had already begun a course in Latin American history before I went to Europe, or just at the time I went to Europe, I was very anxious to build up Latin American materials of which we had nothing. As a matter of fact, when I gave the course on English history, we had 10 copies of one textbook and nothing else on English history at the time.
Okay.
And we had nothing else for outside reading in our other courses. So the Department of History got the idea that we would charge a fee in our lower division courses. With that fee, we would buy one copy of the textbook for each three or four students, and with the rest of the money, we would buy our supplementary reading, and that's how we began to build up that library in history, because we had quite a number of students in my history 8. That's how I built up my section. Leonard had quite a few, and Leslie had quite a number in his modern European history. So we had the jump on most of the students, but they always looked down upon me as, because I was interested in research and in publications. None of the rest of them were interested in that. I never paid any attention. I was a young fella and I was interested in making a name, although I wasn't interested in going away. I got spoiled like most people got spoiled and get spoiled today. You get into a climate that you like, a school that you like, and you get into a salary that's a little bit higher. And I was offered every kind of a instructorship in most of the Middle Western and Southern universities, all to go back to an instructor, but for some reason or another, I learned better in my later days, but I didn't know it at the time. I refused to go back on both the title or in salary. Probably that's the reason why I stay where I am.
Maybe that snow in Iowa was too discouraging.
Well, maybe that has something to do with it. There's no question about it. And my work here kept me here, into here. During the Depression, when we got that fee idea.
Oh, yeah.
When we got all kinds of students, our classes were filled. Mine were quite big. We had no limits on them at the time, except for room limits or what we could accommodate them into it. And I, much to the chagrin of a good many of them out here, I had that SS-100 for my History 8 from the very first day that it came out here. till I went out. and so did Leslie for quite a while, because Leslie had as many, if not more. Much later on, I had overcome and got more than the capacity of SS-100, so I had to give two sections in that. That's much later on. As we progressed in the 30s and as we were developing our upper division and curriculum into there, we got to the point where we were getting real students. The Depression undoubtedly kept a number of San Diegans who were excellent students from going away because they couldn't afford it anymore, hence we reaped that, and there's no question about it. Secondly, the fact that we granted the AB and degree with education at first and then without the education units later on also helped out. as a result of which we pulled in a full AB major. We were one of the first to have a full, and we were all prepared at the time for it. And we even gave a course in historiography, where we got the idea of training people in writing and